Hello there and welcome. Today is Wednesday, June 20th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, protests, but no solutions yet as outrage over separation of families at the U.S. border continues.
We don't want people pouring into our country. We want them to come in through the process, through the legal system.
EU leaders are meeting to deal with their own migrant crisis. Also ahead, a popular boy band making a comeback with a new single hit. It's all on today's International Edition. Hundreds of protesters gathered in Washington, D.C., outside the office of U.S. Customs and Border Protection headquarters Tuesday as outrage over the policy of separating detained parents and children who cross the border illegally continues. In a speech on Tuesday to small business owners in Washington, President Trump defended the policy amid intense criticism across the political spectrum.
We want to solve this problem. We want to solve family separation. I don't want children taken away from parents. And when you prosecute the parents for coming in illegally, which should happen, you have to take the children away. Now, we don't have to prosecute them, but then we're not prosecuting them for coming in illegally. That's not good.
Trump claimed there are only two options to deal with the situation: totally open borders or criminal prosecution. He said he wants Congress to provide him with a third option to deport families as a unit. Congressional Republicans have been scrambling to craft legislation as videos of youngsters in cages and an audio tape of wailing children have sparked anger at home from groups ranging from clergy to influential business leaders as well as internationally. The UN Refugee Agency said Tuesday a record 68.5 million people around the world have been forced to flee their homes last year due to war, violence, and persecution. European Union leaders met Tuesday ahead of a summit next week on how to deal with the influx of migrants. And at next week's summit in Brussels, EU leaders are hoping to agree on a joint migration policy 3 years after more than 1 million people arrived in Europe, causing a crisis for the Union. Joining us now from France, Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, tell us about the meeting.
There's a meeting not far from Berlin with the German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President Emmanuel Macron. Really was a step towards making sure that the European Union, all the nations of the European Union, put their heads together and come up very quickly with some sort of solution to what's been known now as the migrant crisis. It's now into its third year. And even though the numbers of migrants arriving on European shores is much lower, we're looking at 2017, there were only 700,000 migrants paired with almost double that the year before. Even though these numbers are down, certainly the divisions within Europe as to how these people should be dealt with are very stark. You get on the one side, you're having populist right-wing forces who are saying to shut down the borders, do not let people in. And then you've got people like Chancellor of Germany. She is saying, no, we've got to, if you like, look after these people, not just welcome them, but we also have to process their papers. They have to be treated like human beings. And that, again, was what Emmanuel Macron was saying. You have to deal with these people. You have to look after them. You have to process their applications for asylum. You have to weed out the economic migrants from the genuine asylum seekers, and you have to have something in place so that you can do it. Both of them came away saying that the European Union has to get together and do this all together as a group and not just turn its back or, as is the case in some countries, just put up their borders and say no migrants at all.
We obviously have heard about the tragedies at sea with these migrants being held out on these ships. That can't be allowed to continue, or can it?
It can't be allowed to continue, and there's several initiatives that Emmanuel Macron and Angela Merkel have come up with. One of these suggestions is that the EU find so-called safe harbors close to Libya. And that if you have these safe harbors, that would be back where the migrants are taken, and there you would have, if you like, accelerated procedures in place, with officials in place there, that these people could have their asylum applications seen to there. Another possibility is, of course, that Europe just reinforces its borders. And one of the suggestions is that the European Border Force just has a whole lot more border patrols. They only have several thousand at the moment. If they bring that number up to around 10,000 border police by the end of 2027, they say that will help. The other suggestion that has really come from the French president is that all the countries have to work as one with the countries of origin and the countries of transit. And in particular, they're talking about working with officials in Libya and in Niger, and that you set up camps there where people who would otherwise have gone through the desert, gone to Libya and got on a boat, instead they go to these camps that have United Nations officials, and they also have International Office of Migration officials there, and they will look at their documentation, and if need be, from there to France or to the Netherlands. So there is, if you like, a blueprint to that happening. But Emmanuel Macron, the French president, says that's the way that we should be looking at. Have to stop all these people getting on these boats, setting sail across the Mediterranean for days, if not weeks on end.
I understand there may be a meeting that is planned for the near future to actually talk about setting this up.
It is indeed. This is going to be the big issue. It's going to be on the 27th and 28th of June. All the heads of government of the European Union countries will be getting together in Brussels to try and come up with a united solution. Now, the big problem is, of course, at the moment, the European Union says the rule is whichever country a migrant arrives in, he has to apply for asylum there. That first country has to take that migrant in and process them. The problem with that is that that puts a big, enormous burden on two particular countries, Italy and Greece, and they just cannot cope with these numbers. On top of that, Europe does not have a unified, if you like, standard for asylum seekers. So if a migrant gets refused asylum in Italy, they can then go on, for example, to France and try and see if they meet the criteria in France. So you get all this migration, asylum shopping going on, where you have these migrants wandering around Europe, putting in their application again. So what the Europeans really want to look at again is that you reduce that migrant flow, you help these borderline countries where all these migrants are coming into, and on top of that, and this is going to be the really difficult thing, is to have a unified policy on who gets asylum. At the moment, you don't have that. You don't have that because Italy has taken such a hard line with accepting migrants. You've also got Austria, which is taking a very hard line, doesn't want to have a new influx of migrants coming in. You've got countries such as Poland, Hungary, that don't want any and want to put borders up again. And then you've got countries like France, Germany, and Spain that say, hang on a minute, let's look at their applications first.
That's Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. We appreciate it. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. China calls Trump's threat of more tariffs blackmail. Afghan officials hold security talks with a Pakistan spy chief. Federal agent at the center of the Clinton email probe controversy has been escorted from the building. And Kenya seeks to boost girls' education by providing free sanitary products. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. And on our VOA mobile app, this is International Edition. Chinese President Xi Jinping says he hopes North Korea and the United States can implement the agreement they reached at last week's historic summit in Singapore, according to China's state broadcaster CCTV. Xi made his comments as he welcomed North Korean leader Kim Jong-un to China. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Clayton Dube, who heads the USC-US-China Institute at the University of Southern California, and asked what he thinks would be the priorities of both leaders.
In going to Beijing, again, the optics matter a lot. And the fact that Beijing treated this visit as it treats most visits of foreign leaders, That is to say, they announced it, and they announced it roughly at the time that it was happening, as opposed to waiting until Kim Jong-un left Beijing. And so they were sending a signal that North Korea is increasingly a normal country, and it's going to be treated as such. So that's one of the things that Beijing was conveying. Xi Jinping also wanted to make it clear that, you know, whatever happened in recent years, China intends to be a partner with North Korea. Now, what Kim Jong-un wanted, of course, was sanctions relief. And informally, it seems that some of that has already happened, that goods are moving a little bit more easily across the China-North Korea border. But he wants China at the UN Security Council to push for a formal lightening of that burden.
What do you think Xi Jinping wants to see the situation become between China, North Korea, and the United States?
But it's also going to be contentious because the relationship has never been an especially smooth one. Now, with the United States is, of course, a military and economic superpower. It is allied with the countries that North Korea most worries about, South Korea and Japan. And so it needs to work with the United States, and it wants to work with the United States. It wants the United States to be the ultimate guarantor of North Korean security, and it wants to have a relationship with the United States that means it can't be pushed around by China.
All right, that's Clayton Dube, who heads the U.S.-China Institute at USC, the University of Southern California. The U.S. has pulled out of the United Nations Human Rights Council, calling it a cesspool of political bias, especially where Israel is concerned. U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley accused the council of having a chronic bias against Israel, lamenting the council has had such notorious human rights abusers as Venezuela, Cuba, China, and the Democratic Republic of Congo as members.
In doing so, I want to make it crystal clear that this step is not a retreat from human rights commitments. On the contrary, we take this step because our commitment does not allow us to remain a part of a hypocritical and self-serving organization that makes a mockery of human rights.
VOA's Victor Beatty asks University of South Carolina political science professor Yosef Elmert for his reaction.
Well, it's long overdue, I would say, because, look, this council is an anti-Semitic body, and on top of that, it's also anti-American, you know, and the UN has really been bankrupt morally for many years. Just recently, to give you an example, they selected Syria, of all countries, to be the chair country of the committee to deal with chemical weapons. Do you believe that? Look, this council has become an arena for anti-Semitic propaganda for years. They have Chapter 7, or Clause 7, as they call it there, which basically says that in every discussion they have about every subject, they would raise objections of Israel policy, whatever. What is it if not bias? And it's not just the U.S. Yesterday, the foreign minister of Great Britain declared that if this clause will not abolished, Britain will automatically vote against any decision about Israel from now on. So you see a growing body of opinion here in the Western world, I hope in other parts of the world, that really relate to this council as it is, you know, a biased, hateful organization.
UN Human Rights Chief Zayd Raad Al Hussein called the decision regrettable. He said, given the state of human rights in today's world, the U.S. should be stepping up, not stepping back.
Who is he to say it? I mean, he comes from the Kingdom of Jordan, which is not known exactly for human rights and all this. You know, just recently, there were riots in Jordan in protest against the government there, and they were suppressed by the regime. Look, he made a big mistake, this fellow, because that will create a problem between Jordan and the U.S., but that's a problem between these two countries, and I don't want to get into that.
The head of Human Rights Watch said the council has played an important role in countries like North Korea, Syria, Myanmar, South Sudan, but he said all Trump seems to care about is defending Israel.
Well, again, this is a nonsensical statement. What is he talking about? What role did they play in Syria? 600,000 people were killed there. What role did they play in Syria? What is this nonsense? Look, the fact that people make statements like this just shows to you exactly the bankruptcy of the UN. And you can hear in my voice that I'm angry, because enough is enough about all that. Why do people have to wake up every morning to hear all these criticisms of Israel when you really have these atrocities in other countries, for example, in Syria? What did this council do about the use of chemical weapons by the Syrian regime? Well, what is he talking about?
European Union said Washington's decision risks undermining the role of the U.S. as a champion and supporter of democracy on the world stage.
Okay, so that's what the EU says, and in the meantime, I would advise the EU to deal with the issues of migration in Europe and what happens in some European countries and how they treat their so-called refugees or migrants or any of those issues, you know. It's about time that countries deal with their own problems first and foremost, rather than preaching morality to others while doing in their own countries what they criticize in other countries.
What happens to the Council with the U.S. withdrawal?
Well, I hope that this council will be disbanded. What can I tell you? I mean, you know, they have no role the way they operate, and without the U.S., it has no meaning, really. I mean, I believe also that the U.S. would withdraw their financial support from the council. So, I mean, you know, hopefully this council will be disbanded.
City of South Carolina political science professor Yosef Omert, UN Human Rights Chief Zayed Ra'ad Al Hussein, said given the state of human rights in the world today, the U.S. should be stepping up, not stepping back. Several rights groups warned the U.S. withdrawal will make it more difficult to advance rights priorities and aid victims of abuse around the world. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Sporty greetings to all our VOA listeners. This is Sonny Young, host of The Sunny Side of Sports.
We will rock you.
Please join me at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC, Monday through Friday, for special World Cup updates during the month-long football festival in Russia. Right here on The Voice of America.
I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, in World Cup action, Russia advanced closer to the final 16, beating Egypt Tuesday 3-1. Meanwhile, Senegal is the lone African country to win the first round, defeating Poland 2-1. The World Cup, being hosted by Russia, is the most expensive ever, with the official price tag at around $15 billion. The result, several huge new stadiums, railroads, and upgraded airports, plus the chance to reboot Russia's global image. So will the tournament represent a good value for Russians? As Henry Ridgewell reports from Moscow, the government appears to have used the World Cup to bury some bad economic news.
Officially, Russia has spent close to $3 billion on 12 new or upgraded stadiums. At least another $8 billion has been spent on infrastructure. But was it good value for the money?
The discussion of the efficiency of the championship in Russia, like in Brazil, is the discussion of economic efficiency of a wedding dress. On one hand, it's necessary. It makes everybody happy. The exact economic efficiency definitely cannot be defined in American quarterly financial reports. It's a long-term story. We still hope to become not only hockey country, but football country.
Brazil hosted the last World Cup in 2014 at a cost of $11 billion. 4 years later, many of their traveling fans feel shortchanged.
Comparing Brazil with Russia, the infrastructure here is much better than ours. This is the biggest number of tourists that Moscow has ever seen. And in total, they're doubtless spending billions of rubles having a good time. But after they've all gone home in 4 weeks, Russia hopes there will be a longer-term benefit to hosting the World Cup.
The $15 billion investment is aimed at giving Russia an image makeover in the eyes of the world, even as it faces sanctions over its invasion of Ukraine.
Putin, with all this strength, pretends that all that is not important for him. Despite sanctions, we conduct such a gorgeous World Cup. Despite sanctions, we go ahead with the war in Syria, and the world has no right to lecture us. And the people enjoy that until the very moment that they start feeling that for all this pleasure, they are paying out of their own pockets. It is right now that they start feeling that.
First to feel it are the middle-aged. On the opening day of the World Cup last week, the government announced a gradual rise in the pension age from 60 to 65 for men and a bigger jump, 55 to 63 for women. 62-year-old Ava says most Russians are taking it in their stride.
It wasn't really unexpected. Probably they thought the championship, the euphoria, will somehow smooth out the effect. There was a joke going around. Yesterday I had 4 years until pension age. Today I have 9 years. And they keep telling us that you can't get your youth back.
Russia says the World Cup is partly a gift for its youth. Unforgettable memories and glittering new facilities. The tournament finishes in a month. Its legacy will be measured in the coming years. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Moscow.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
That's the voice and guitar of Mutinda Muteti performing in Nairobi, Kenya. Since 2015, he's been playing music to lift spirits at the three branches of the Nairobi Women's Hospital for patients like Tabitha Carrera.
The music is so sweet. It's actually, you know, the music is therapeutic.
Muteti says playing for patients who were in pain was difficult at first, but after seeing the effect music had on them, he continued.
It gives me a really good feeling that every day I can come in and at least make someone smile.
According to researchers in Switzerland, music can help the body heal. They say patients who listen to music can have lower levels of pain, anxiety, blood pressure, and heart rate following surgery. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter. Every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
Well, a music group that first shot to popularity more than two decades ago has a new single. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London joins International Edition's Sarah Williams with the very latest.
All the way back to 1996, the Backstreet Boys are back. They sang a hit song called The Backstreet Boys Are Back, and in this case, it rings true. These guys formed in 96, which is, what, 23 years ago, approximately, in Orlando, Florida. In 2015, they were on a 20th anniversary tour together, and they are getting ready to release their ninth studio album together. So I've got some Backstreet Boys news, but first we're going to lay their new song on you, which is called Don't Go Breaking My Heart.
I got mixed emotions. Did I finally find me a river that could lead me out to the ocean? Cause I've only ever known the kind of love that leaves you battered and broken. So forgive me for my mixed emotions.
So why are they coming together at this point?
You know, over the years, they've tried other things. Many boy bands, One Direction and groups like that, will all of a sudden decide it's time to try something solo. And they do, and they go in different directions. Kevin Richardson left the group, but then he rejoined the group. So they have decided in the last couple of years that now is a good time for the Backstreet Boys to come back. In fact, they recently had a Las Vegas residency. They were there for quite a few shows, a long run, sold out. They've done cruises before, and they've got a documentary film about them. And like I say, the ninth album, which is expected out in October. And so they just kind of have had a loyal legion of fans who've been following them for 23 years now. The band have sold over 100 million records around the world, and they're, you know, one of just a very few handful of bands to ever achieve that number. And so, you know, they thought the fans were there, and probably, quite frankly, they got a little bored, I would guess, if you're not working and recording and hearing the fans cheering for you. And that's what you've done your whole life, you tend to miss it. Even if you're in your 40s, you still miss it. You had it when you were in your 20s. And so I think that guys like Nick Carter and AJ and the rest of the guys decided now's a good time. And they're also still doing other things, like AJ McLean has just recently released a country music single. So they are doing different things, and they still work as the Backstreet Boys as well. And their ninth album's coming out. And it'll be a different vibe and a different fan base, I'm sure, because their fans have grown up. So it won't be the 12-year-olds buying their music. We'll have to wait and see how that all turns out. But the new song is called Don't Go Breaking My Heart.
All right, thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings. Baby, don't go.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On June 20th, we observe World Refugee Day. It is an occasion to highlight the plight of refugees around the world, commend their resilience, and express gratitude to their hosts. According to the 1951 Convention on the Status of Refugees, a refugee is someone who, owing to a well-founded fear of being persecuted for reasons of race, religion, nationality, membership of a particular social group or political opinion, is outside the country of his nationality and is unable to, or owing to such fear, is unwilling to avail himself of the protection of that country. In 2017, the world's refugee population topped 25 million, more than ever before. The displaced come from all walks of life, singly and in families, across a wide spectrum of ethnic, religious, economic, and educational backgrounds. But they have one thing in common. All have been forced from their homes and homelands. They flee to escape persecution or violent conflict, including terrorism. Often people flee because their towns have been turned into battlefields, and staying means nearly certain death. This is a global crisis that is affecting more men, women, and children than ever before, and for longer and longer periods of time. As we observe World Refugee Day, we are reminded that as long as violence and persecution continue, there will be a pressing need for comprehensive humanitarian action and a global response. That is why the United States is proud to continue its leadership in providing humanitarian aid around the world. This life-saving assistance protects refugees, feeds those who might otherwise starve, shelters those who would otherwise be exposed to the elements, ensures access to safe, clean water and basic health care, and more. The United States is a nation of immigrants, and as Deputy Secretary John Sullivan said, helping those in need is and always has been one of our country's core values.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.